Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 126 with the title, Reframing Our World. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Lena Jankauskait. Lena is a trained psychologist, a certified holistic life coach, psychoeducator, trainer, a speaker, and a dreamer. When I asked Lena to describe her superpower, she said, it is her undefeatable belief that in humans, both individually and collectively, that at their core are good, giving, willing, and caring. Hello, Lena. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joanne. Well, thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. We did practice your surname a couple of times in the green room before we came on. I was determined to get it right. So, reframing our world, you've obviously got a rich heritage and past. Tell us about yourself and what you believe in.
In terms of who I am, I suppose there's those sort of demographical, biographical things, which is I originate from Lithuania. I came to the UK nearly 20 years ago. And I suppose I matured in the UK. I was 20 when I came, and I matured here in the UK. And I can hardly remember myself or what I was before, because I think I changed quite a bit, seeing the world around me, being exposed to a lot more in the UK than I have been in Lithuania, because I grew up in a small, small town, provincial, very small town. So I always say that whilst Lithuania is always going to be my home, the UK is really what made me up to this point, what I am. And yes, as you said, I am a dreamer, and I dream about exactly that. Like the title of the episode really speaks to it really well. I want, as cliche as it sounds, I want to change the world, to leave that little bit better place than I found it. So however little I can contribute to it, it all adds up. Again, loads of cliches, but I just truly believe in that. And I'll try to do my bit in that changing of the world by helping people to really to see the opportunities on how they can contribute to changing the world. And I know it sounds really abstract, but that's just because it's a big aim to change the world. So yeah, at the minute it sounds a bit abstract, but there's many things I'm doing. As you said, I'm a coach. I fancy myself a self-leadership coach, because I think that's where it all starts, really, from self-leadership, because that's where how you relate to the rest of the world, to your environment, to the fellow human, to the tree out, you know, outside. It all comes down to that, how you relate to the rest of the world starts with self-leadership. So I think that's my starting point in changing the world.
Interesting. My knowledge of Lithuania is tiny. I went for a 3-day conference. This is probably best part of 20 years ago. So probably about the time you were still there. So the capital is Vilnius, is that right? Vilnius?
That's right, yeah.
Vilnius. And it's very old, traditional kind of Baltic-y sort of state, and yeah, large squares, cobbles, ancient architecture, beautiful construction, churches and things. And I remember it being very iconic when I was there. But as I say, it was mainly a quick tour of the centre and a tour of the nightlife and a tour of, had some a couple of boring meetings to attend as well. So yeah, it was a quick in and out. I'd love to go back. I spent a bit of time in Estonia, mainly in Tallinn and the surrounding area, and I did pop to Riga once as well in Latvia. So yeah, it's I've always got a fond place in my heart for those regions because of the people. I found the people really warm, easy to connect to, and not at all how I imagined. It's very forward thinking, certainly in the last 10-15 years. A lot of tech startups and developing economy there is phenomenal. And you're right, you must have had this complete transformation about how you saw the world, as you say, coming from rural Lithuania to entering sort of like the UK and the hustle and bustle of our life, if you like.
It was very much so, because the town I grew up in is considered the eighth or the ninth biggest town in Lithuania, but because Lithuania is tiny, I think the population when I was still there was about 35,000, which now has dropped to below 30,000. And like I said, it's considered eighth or the ninth biggest town in Lithuania. So just for people get the idea of scale. And it was very, I mean, I had a great time growing up, and I'm still very fond of my hometown, even though there's no one and nothing there now for me when I go back. But when I first arrived in the UK, I found myself in London, as most of us do. So the contrast was wow. However, what I didn't expect was, because I knew Britain through watching, because I was a diehard fan of Sherlock Holmes series. So I expected it. I arrived on the 4th of September, actually. I can't remember the year, but I remember the date. It was the 4th of September. And I was expecting it to be, you know, this narrow streets, cobble streets as well, with sort of greyish, darkish, with this mist, you know, everything covered in mist. And I arrived at it was like 30-odd degrees. I think it's one of the hottest summers or hottest ends of summers that's, you know, on record at the time. And I was like, whoa, what the hell? That's what I expected.
Yeah, I mean, there are parts of London that are sort of narrow streets and cobbles, especially in the kind of the square mile right in the city. There's a real kind of intricate little cobbled areas. You know, a lot of London got rebuilt after the fire in London and after the war and things like this. But yeah, you can still find those old streets. But yeah, we're not even the mythical 221 or whatever it is, Baker Street. I think it's the 221B, is it Baker Street, or whatever the address is. That's in a quite a wide road. It's in a row. I mean, yeah, the row it's in is very old, traditional Victorian type of architecture. I don't know if you've done the Sherlock Holmes Museum. I did the Sherlock Holmes Museum, or that visit that place probably 10-15 years ago. And it's a good opportunity to sort of see Victorian life, if or how people from the Victorian era lived, because it's still kitted out in that way. But yeah, no, I don't think we're probably not at all like our stereotypes that you see in the movies or on the telly.
That, yes, in my experience, obviously they are. It's hard to tell, because when I first came, like I said, I was 20, so I knew very little. It was going to be a 6 month break, and then I was going to go back and re-enroll uni, which I quit because I didn't like what I chose. So being 20 years old, I didn't really care about many things, you know, that I do now. And so I arrived with any stereotype in my head in terms of the lifestyle. I think it was just that picture that I held in my head, you know, this darkish, gloomish, mistish kind of, you know, from Sherlock Holmes. But in terms of everything else, I don't think I had any preconceptions. But like I said, I'm struggling to remember myself, what I was like back then. But it was, yes, because I found myself on Oxford Street. So yes, that was... But it was... What I found, because I didn't have any preconceptions, or not that I remember of, the only emotion that I feel, I don't know, emotion, feeling, not entirely sure how to describe that, was awe, I was in awe of how many people of the hustle and bustle. I've never seen anything like it in my life. But for me, it was just amazement and like, wow, oh my God, I cannot believe this. I cannot believe I'm here. And and just everyone going, these masses of people going around their business. And it's just, the pace. I was just in awe.
I would imagine that this is just me having a guess here, that there must be 30,000 people in that Oxford Street area at any one time, which is bigger than the population of your hometown. And it's like kind of incredible, And I guess coming from a town where there were so few people, you kind of know everybody, or you're connected with people in some way. It's most of the streets, most of the locations, and suddenly coming to, and I'm not saying by any stretch of the means that UK is a huge country. It's not. London does feel quite huge when you're in the middle of it sometimes, but coming to a city that is massively bigger than what you expected. Did you find it unfriendly? Did you find it unwelcoming, or just, as you say, in awe?
I didn't. Actually, not at all, because I didn't actually. I didn't get that feeling. Yes, I was just in awe. So I was more, I think I was more at the time, I found myself in the position of observer rather than a participant in that. So I would literally, I was a heavy smoker at the time, not anymore, but I was a heavy smoker at the time. So I really enjoyed for the first few days in London to just sit either on the small park bench, the small parks that are off the major streets, which you can still people watch when sitting there. You can see them. So obviously if you go to Hyde Park, you see a lot of people in Hyde Park, but you don't see these busy hustle and bustle streets so clearly. So I would really enjoy just sit on the park bench and just to watch the people by having a cigarette and a Red Bull at the time. And I think because I just found myself, I can't say I put myself in that position, I just found myself in that position that I was an observer of the world around me. I didn't encounter or I didn't perceive any unfriendliness or unapproachability. And as far as I remember, when you ask for directions or you ask for which bus you need to take to get in there, people were very willing to share the information with you, and they wouldn't, even in that hustle and bustle, they would really actually stop rather than just say right, so straight and then fifth right and walk away. It wasn't like that. People would actually still take that extra 10 seconds, extra 15 seconds to say, right, so yeah, if you carry on straight, you're going to need to take a fifth right, you're going to see this in the shop and go around there. So they really put the effort into, even because at the time, obviously I will always have the accent, and that time my accent was very heavy. And I didn't, for one moment, I didn't perceive anything. I was an observer to begin with, but when I was a participant in terms of interacting with people and with the environment, it was fine. It was good. It was lovely.
So, as you say, you're an observer before you participated in, I guess if you're there for a break, 6 months, you weren't looking to necessarily come here and reside. How did you, because you must have started to develop that sense of belongingness to where you were living, to what you were doing. Because if you just stayed an observer, you wouldn't have felt the connection in order to stay here. Is that true?
You know what? The way you said it, it makes a lot of sense. I never thought about it in that way, but that is absolutely true. Yeah, because I came because I quit uni. So I finished school. I quit uni because I didn't like what I chose, and I thought, right, I have to wait until the next academic year starts, and English is the only language that I know. I know I want to see the world a little bit, so I'll come to the UK for about 6 months, then go back and re-enroll. So that was the intention of the plan, but I enjoyed myself in that diverse, very, because I worked, my first job was working in a restaurant at Stansted Airport. And out of 99 members of staff, there was one British person and one Irish person. And the rest were probably from like 30 different countries. And so I can't say I learned much English there, because obviously we all, you know, we all communicated in our broken English at the time. I probably built a vocabulary, but, you know, just the vocabulary. But it was a wonderful experience, because I had never been exposed to different cultures. I had never been exposed to different views of life, and I've never been exposed to different, well, metaphysical positions, if you will. And it was a very beautiful experience. I think maybe I found myself belonging, and I don't know. I'm just sort of analyzing in my head now as I, on the spot, maybe the reason why I've started feeling like, right, I want to stick around for a bit longer and see where it takes me, because partly it was a very enriching experience. And I suppose maybe in my first job in the UK, we probably connected because we were all immigrants, and we were all, some were trying to make it, some of us were like myself, just here for possibly a brief break and seeing the world. So I don't know, but yes, as you said it, now I'm thinking that I must have found that belonging, because 20 years on nearly, I'm still here.
No, for sure. So you mentioned earlier about self-leadership being one of the sort of key fundamentals for taking personal responsibility, and your passion for changing the world, because you have to start with yourself, don't you, to change the world?
Absolutely. And you absolutely have to start with yourself. And we just recently we had, you know, this is going to be where I'm going to go off on tangents so much, so feel free to just, yeah. You have to, it's very cliche as well. A lot of people, oh yeah, we heard that before, start with yourself, but you know, whatever, what does that actually mean? And a lot of people are really, really disempowered. And this is not either or, it's a spectrum of the level of disempowerment. And a lot of people, they won't perceive themselves as that. We won't perceive ourselves as that. But I found myself often feeling like I have no control of things. And this is where, when you have no control of things, you can feel disempowered. You wouldn't necessarily put that particular name of it, like I feel disempowered. We use all sorts of language to describe that, like, oh, this can't be done, or, well, it doesn't work like that, or, well, it's always been that way, why would it change? Oh, nobody cares, nothing's going to change. So it's reflected in our language that living in a somewhat disempowered state, if you will. And I catch myself now. I mean, I catch myself more and more now, because that's my job, and I've been focusing it for quite a few years now on yet self-development, on observing how I relate to the world. And even though I fancy myself knowing better, I still get caught out. I still get into that. I don't particularly like that term, but people use it, victim mentality. It's not a nice term, but I haven't thought of anything better yet, other than just in that disempowered mode. But when I catch myself, because I've been really self-developing for years and years now, I am able to catch myself using the language that keeps me stuck in that disempowered mode. So I'm able to catch it sooner, and I'm able to rationalize in my head, think, right, hang on a second, get a grip of yourself. So I think that's kind of the core of that self-leadership, just striving to, because there's always going to be things that are out of our control. And we can only act in whatever circumstances we are at the time, but we can act either from the disempowered mode, where we just go with what things are and just live an unhappy, miserable life, or we can be in the same place where we have no control of certain things, but we can decide to do whatever we can to change our own reality around us in the hope that it will ripple. So
you talked about victim mentality, and I can relate to the concept here. Is this internalization you feel sometimes, or you feel other people's language being used against you sometimes, and that can cause you to sometimes fight back, to be angry, to be frustrated? And it takes a real strength of character to be able to step back, reflect, and then refocus who you are, what you're trying to say, without feeling that pressure of others who judge you. And I think that's what you're trying to say there, is this: the victim mentality is where you're living in a world of oppression or marginalization, and how do you step into that and with the strength? Because it can be exhausting, can't it, to try and keep overcoming that adversity.
It can be very exhausting, or if you keep overcoming, it can be exhausting. But if you know where you're going at, you kind of, you know, you can be fueled by your end goal. However, it is. So, for example, to address what you were saying, in one of my talks, one of my talks is exactly that. You know, disempowering language and how to take our control back. And in the talk, I give examples. So, for example, and this is in our daily language, which, you know, we use it flippantly a lot of times. We don't really think, and it's easily done. We all fall for it. But the brain, that's how the brain works, like brain plasticity, the way the pathways form from young ages. The language constructs the way we relate to the world. So, for example, if someone pulled in front of me in traffic as I'm driving, I'm a lot better now. I was a lot worse than before, but I could really get into this rage, I suppose, because a lot of times the expression of the sense of lack of power in the situation a lot of times is expressed as anger. And so I would get into that rage. I mean, I wouldn't act on it. I wouldn't start, you know, beeping my horn or throwing coffee cups at the car. I wouldn't act on it, but it would simmer inside me. And I had to find the ways, ultimately, at some point, going through life, probably studying and just generally maturing, it dawned on me that, right, the only person that is suffering the situation now is you. That person, they pulled in and moved on. And the way it is, for example, reflected in a language. So we could say, oh, he pissed me off, or she does my head in, or they always do that to me. And this is a very flippant use of language, which we do because it's a everyday language, and we all do that. And I say it myself. But if we stop for a second to reframe the way we say it, so if you think, oh, she pissed me off, for example. Well, that's it. So you are that passive agent in the situation because she acted upon you. And if you reframe, for example, just take that 1 second to reframe that exactly the same situation into saying, I feel pissed off because of what you said or what she did. The situation is still the same. And the trouble is, a lot of, in this situation, when I try and suggest that people could reframe it like that, some people can feel very defensive and say, so are you saying that it's my fault that I feel that way? And that's not at all what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's anybody's fault that someone feels the way that they do. I'm saying that is, if you think that I feel how I feel because of what's been done to me, the situation is the same. There's an objective truth that something was done that, you know, you were wronged in the same situation here, if you use the same as someone pulled in front of you, to use a simple example. So yes, you were potentially wronged and the feelings are justified, but do they serve you? And if they don't serve you, you can either stay in that self-righteous place, which is justified, absolutely justified, but where is that going to take you? All you're doing, you're killing your own nerve cells by feeling like you do. You're not able to show up your best self in your following interactions for the rest of the day, possibly, let's say. Whereas if only you just say, I feel pissed off because of what she did. So the situation is the same. You justify it, you feel like you do, but it doesn't serve you. So when you say that I feel pissed off, the way the brain works, it just opens more possibilities of right, I don't want to feel that way. What can I do about it? Whereas if you say that, oh, she pissed me off, well, there's nothing you can do about the fact that she pissed you off. There's nothing you can do. So you stay in that passive role, whereas you're the passive participant in the situation where something or someone acted upon you. Whereas if you just own the feelings, recognize that this is how I feel, I'm justified to feel that way, but I don't want to feel that way. And if you just reframe the language, it is really, it sounds so simplistic, but if people use it consciously over, say, I don't know, a period of 30 days when just trying to catch yourself, you will notice that it will become easier and easier to catch yourself because you will literally be rewiring your brain. I mean, there's a lot of that same buzzword, rewiring your brain. But it is absolutely true. The way that neuroplasticity works, the way you break the cycles and the way you build the new connections, you will literally rewire your brain where it will become much easier to catch yourself using that disempowered and disempowering language, whether it's out loud or whether it's your internal dialogue, depending on the situation. And then you see a lot more opportunities when you say, right, this is what I'm doing. What can I do to change that?
Yeah, I think right at the beginning, I mentioned your superpower and your undefeatable belief that we as a human species are at our core good, giving, willing and caring is what I said and what you wrote. Most people who, as you use the phrase, piss you off, generally they don't set out with that intent. And I appreciate there's a huge difference between intent and impact. We can unpack that as well. But inherently, people don't do something. Like when someone cuts you up in the road or pulls in front of you, they're not doing it to disadvantage you. They're doing it to think, oh, I'm in the wrong place. I need to get in. I need to pull in. And it's almost like if you beep your horn, they go, oops, sorry. Whereas if you just take it as kind of they're trying to live their best life, you're trying to live your best life. And there's a little bit of a conflict of how you would treat that. And the trouble is, I think what you're saying here is we want to police people back into a box. This is my rule set. You've broken my rule set. I want to tell you what you've done to my rule set. And I need to crusade against this. Whereas if you just go, yeah, they didn't do it deliberately to piss me off. They did it because they thought they were, yeah. And otherwise you start inventing things in your head about how they're feeling or what's going on in their life or whatever thing. And again, we don't know what that person's going through. They might have gone, ha, 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 I'm going to deliberately park in front of you or cut you up. But they probably didn't even think that. They just saw a gap and took an advantage. And some people like that, some people aren't. As you say, I like the analogy of road rage because we want to try and stop people doing it again. No, it's not right. And that's the ability to step back, have that anger. I always think of it as screwing up a bit of paper and just pop it in the bin. I've been angry. I've now thrown it in the bin. Plop, it's gone. Move on.
That is absolutely. I could. You probably saw me nodding my head. My neck's hurting now. I couldn't agree more. And that's where another thing that I really like to talk about, which is about perception, comes in. Because exactly as you said, 99 times out of 100, people go about their own business. And they absolutely, as you said, they don't intentionally wrong anyone. And the way I deal with it, I have my own strategy. So you have your, piece of paper that you just throw in the bin. The way I deal with it, again, for example, if it's going back to that traffic example, where someone cuts you off or someone's going 40 in a 60 mile zone. And obviously you're in the rush, you need to be somewhere. And then at first you start thinking, oh, for God's sake, why are you even on the road if you don't have to be anywhere? But the way that I then reframe the situation, and that works for me, so everyone needs to find their own. Mine is, right, I bet you they are carrying an injured animal to the vets. And obviously they can't go fast because they can't jerk the poor pet around or whatever animal that is not necessarily a pet. And the moment I reframed that situation, I couldn't care less that it's possibly not true, but it works for me. And I just use that. So this is what they're doing. And this is why they're going slow. This is why they're going slow around the corners, even slower, because, you know, they have an injured pet in the car. So we can all find ways that works for us. But that's exactly, I couldn't agree more with what you said. It is, I like the way you put it, actually. Yeah, that's, there's someone infringe on our set of rules about, you know, transpersonal interactions. Or and yeah, that's, so perception is one very big thing. But I think also we can, using the, I mean, obviously that's just one of tools, one of the tools, not the only tool, far from it. But with using the language, we can help ourselves reframe our habitual perceptions in these, you know, repeated social situations where, yeah, someone pulls in front of you in the traffic or pushes in the queue at the supermarket or just anything. Or even if, for example, yeah, technology not working. And I remember I was visiting my mom a few months back and she fired up Zoom because she wanted to remind herself how to put people in the breakout rooms, and something didn't work or something. And she was, oh, all of this is nonsense. And she sort of just stood up and went off in the shop. And now I'm quite petty with the use of language. And I just went, no, hang on a second. This isn't nonsense. It's just, we don't know how to use it, me and you. And when you reframe it, she came back a few minutes later and feeling quite concerned and worried, probably because it was like 9 o'clock in the evening, and then at 8 o'clock in the morning she had to carry out the lesson, or I think it was some demonstration that she had to carry out where, you know, potentially get this project. And so it's important that she knows. And obviously she walked away really discouraged, and really the self-image is suffering, and this, you know, catastrophizing happening in your head when you word it like that. But like I said, me being petty, I insisted that we reword the situation. And she came back just 2-3 minutes later saying, so, okay, so what do we do? And just because I'm not saying just because we reframed it, but I'm saying potentially that was a reason, or potentially that helped because we reframed it, that she came back having found that enough power within her to think, right, so there is something that I can do. So now I need to look what it is that I can do to change the situation, as opposed to leave it, oh, you know what, this is not working, this is all just nonsense, and just walk away feeling like the weight of the world upon you.
Yeah, I did an entrepreneurial startup course with NatWest, I don't know, 10 years ago. And one of the things I learned from that is it's about taking personal responsibility. If I'm late, I had the choice to leave earlier. I had the choice to think about the things that could have gone wrong. I could have planned ahead for the traffic jam. I could have planned ahead for a puncture in my car. I could have planned ahead for running out of fuel. I could have planned ahead for that petrol station not having any fuel and I had to go to the next one. I could have planned for all those things by leaving earlier, making sure I had a full tank of petrol, making sure that I wasn't in a rush, making sure I knew where I was going. I could do all of that myself. Whereas what happens is something goes wrong, and I haven't got enough time, I haven't got enough resources, I haven't got enough of whatever expertise, learning, whatever it may be. So now I'm under pressure to deliver something that I can't because something's got in the way. So if I think backwards far enough, how do I make sure that I never put myself in a situation where something else is going to cause me embarrassment or failure or whatever it is? I don't get it right all the time, but when it happens, I reframe it instantly. I say, yep, I could have left earlier. Yep, I could have foreseen that. Yep, I could have done that. So I don't start blaming other people. I teach it as an exercise in my own head to say, yeah, it's a lesson. I've learned it. Yeah, I chose to risk manage, and the risk overtook me that time. Yeah, it's like if I'm going to do a delivery of a talk or a keynote or some training, I can leave the night before. I can get there earlier. Or I could not say yes to doing two things that were too tight. Yeah, I chose to accept two things, and the gap between them was minimal, and my risk was high. I chose that. So therefore, I shouldn't be stressing somebody else out because of my decision. So I think that's what you're kind of saying here, is making sure that you're taking some personal responsibility, because you have the power, you have the control to say yes, to say no, to think about something.
That is absolutely what I'm saying, yes. And it's a practice. So I imagine even yourself, so for example, I don't know if you, because like I said, I can't remember myself 20 years ago, not very well anyway. But do you remember when it happened, when you went, because as children and then teenagers, we grow up with a lot of that, you know, the world doesn't understand us, the world is against us and things like that. And then obviously as we mature in, we probably step out of that to a certain degree, all of us, out of that victimhood mentality, for want of a better term. But then obviously, again, there's a spectrum. There's a never-ending progress of how far out of it you can step out and continue going. So when you were describing how you approach the situations where, yeah, you were late, for example, to me that sounds like a practice that got you to the place where you are now able, without any bad feelings, to just recognize, you know, I could have done things differently and I wouldn't be in that situation now. Just recognizing that. Because it's a practice that takes you there. Because we don't start off with that. And we're not exactly taught that either, because as children, everything's decided for us. As teenagers, everything's decided. And, you know, all these schools, for example, they really just encourage and enforce conformity to the rules that are imposed on you, which kind of takes away to a degree and everything. I mean, and these are just little examples, but we are taught that, right, there's always an outside factor that has a say in a certain situation. So if we have a headache, more often than not, we will go to the painkillers, then stop to think, right, what could be the reasons why I have a headache? And which is fair enough. Sometimes it's overpowering the headache. You need the painkillers to even be able to think straight. But yeah, to reflect back, to think, so how, you know, try and notice, when did it happen? What could have triggered it? Or, you know, have there been things accumulating over time? Is it body in my tension in my body that's, you know, how long has that been building up? Why was it building up? But so we are taught that there's everything's outside of us. That's what we were taught, in a form of, you know, rules and regulations that we have to conform to. I mean, don't get me wrong, obviously there needs to be rules and regulations to live in a society, but we were never taught that within that container of societal norms, we also have power. So we were never taught that. And that's what I'm saying, it's a practice. So when you described the way you now perceive situations, that sounds to me like you've been practicing for quite a while to get to the point where you're now, where your default now is the recognition that, right, well, I am where I am. I could have done things differently.
I think it was to be honest, it was probably on that entrepreneur course I was on that was kind of, you know, you talk about the work you do about coaching leaders and people to take personal responsibility and to empower themselves. It was that training that I didn't think I had that epiphany before that moment. You know, that's 7 or 8 years ago, and that was, I went through most of my life not understanding that. And I think from that, when we talk about one of the keys of effective leadership is humility, and you're allowed to be wrong. You're allowed to say sorry. I hear so many people say, don't apologize, you know, be like the queen, be like the king, you know, the royal family never apologizes, never explains themselves. And I think, well, yeah, that's not the way I want to live my life. I want to say, if I've made a mistake, I'm sorry. I could have done that better. Yeah, you're right. I didn't approach that in the right way. I've reflected on that and I've taken on board all your comments. Yeah, if I feel I am right, I will stand up for what I think. But I'm also very reflective where, oops, I did carve you up there on the road. I did park you. Yeah, you're right. I should have been more thoughtful. Yes, thank you for pointing that out. You're right. I'm not going to stand here and defend it. Some people want to defend their position, regardless of whether they think, some people defend their position even they know they're not in the right, or they just believe so strongly that they're right, or the other person's so wrong that they want to defend it. And I think humility, saying sorry, admitting it, is because we have this fear of being judged, fear of being wrong, and someone's thinking badly of us. And I think you can apologize in a way that doesn't make people feel badly about you. They feel more trusting of you because they recognize that you are somebody that will tell the truth, and no matter how painful it is. And I think we're taught as kids, aren't we? I think we're taught as kids not to say sorry, or not to admit things, or hide things, or sneak around behind our parents' back, or we do something naughty and we won't tell anybody because there's always punishment for telling the truth. And I think if you can reframe it, if we talk about reframing things, where telling the truth is actually a strength, and being sorry is actually a strength, having humility is actually being a strength, not having all the answers could also be a strength. I think that's what we need to think about in our leadership and self-leadership or leadership of others, is I don't have to be perfect. I have to be the best human I can be and build relationships and collaborate. I don't have to have all the answers.
I couldn't agree more with, honestly, I couldn't agree more, but two things stand out for me. One is that, just thinking which way around, that's defending your position. And I think that is where that self-leadership is really sometimes people ask, well, what do you mean self-leadership? What is it? So for me, that contains several things. It contains, first of all, self-awareness. Another thing it contains would be resilience, because you build the strategies to deal with situations. So hence, it makes you more resilient going forward. So that defensiveness is exactly that. And I think that is the, going back to wanting to change the world, I think that's where it begins, because there's, of course, the systemic things are, we need a lifetime to discuss that. So I'm not going to go into systemic things, but even though sometimes it seems that systems take up a life on their own, I at least personally still strongly believe that the systems are ran by people. The systems have come and gone, and they will continue exactly as they were up to this point, coming and going. And because systems are run by people, systems are created, systems are reframed and redefined by people, it will always, for me, start with people. With individuals. And it is extremely hard, because when you grow up in an environment, and I'm not even going to talk about I'm talking just your general everyday growing up. I'm not talking about people that experience a lot of trauma, because that's, again, another topic. But we grow up in that kind of environment. So where, especially in our Western world, it's very competition orientated. Everything's a competition. The way you're marked at school, there's a lot more competition. And I mean, this is systemic, a lot more competition orientated than it is collaboration orientated when it comes down to it. We hear that word a lot these days, collaboration. But when it comes down to it at the core, from when we were little, it was instilled into us that you have to be better than someone else. And on the one hand, that needing to defend yourself, it's an evolutionary need, because, if you suddenly recognize that actually, I was wrong, or if you don't defend yourself and apologize, it can shatter your self-image, depending on how long you were wrong in your life. In a particular area of the way you conducted your life. And that comes, but the reason why it, threatens your self-image is because of that lack of self-assurance. And self-assurance, it has some bad rep because it's associated with arrogance, you know, on the very sort of superficial plane. But if you're not secure within yourself, if your self-image is dependent on others' perceptions, you will find it very hard to admit fault, even to yourself, never mind to somebody else, because that literally threatens yourself, your identity. Because to say, you know what, I conducted myself wrong for the last 20 years, what are you left with then? So it's a very hard place to be at.
Yeah, you can, if you're not careful, paint yourself into a corner, can't you? You kind of, you back yourself in, and you feel the only way out is to fight, a bit like a cornered animal. Whereas if you can reflect, I mean, I've reflected, I've had some significant life changes over the last 10, 15 years, various things. And I can look back and say, yeah, I woke up 5-10 years ago and I have a different outlook on life. I look back at my past life. I look back at my past history and how I behaved. And I recognize that I could have done better. And I look back and think, I'm not necessarily saying I'm ashamed of who I was or how I acted, but I've reflected on some of those times being not the person how I'd react today. And I've realized that maybe I've put people in situations that weren't fair, or I wasn't treating them with enough respect. And I think I can look back and not necessarily say feel shame about it. I'd be happy to apologize. I'd be happy to reflect and say, you're right, I should have done better. I could have done better. I now know better. I think we shouldn't be afraid to do that. I think if we're not careful, we keep enforcing our rule set. You know, I'm in the corner. I have to fight out of it. I have to keep defending this hill. And sometimes it's just a case of saying, no, you're right. I look back and yeah, I've learned.
And you know, that brings me to the second point of what you previously addressed, which is vulnerability. And in my experience, I observed, but also in my own experience, time and time and time and time again, vulnerability is what connects me to other people, because that defending your corner, it's a very lonely place to be, just that defending your corner no matter what. And it will, because it is threatening your self-image to, you know, if someone says you're wrong, that's when we become defensive, because it's somebody else imposing their worldview and you need to defend it and you're going to think about it later. And it's when we are able to recognize upon reflection that, yeah, we could have done better. That is such a strength on the one hand to be able to say that. It's a very strong thing to do as opposed to weak. I can't even put into words how important that is for me as well, to be able to say, you know what, I was, and I'm not going to lie, there are situations where I sometimes find it hard still, but it's a practice. It's something that I think that I have to do, that I have to do the right thing by that other person, by admitting that I was wrong, by putting them first. And I find that in that process, which is a very, very, it can take to build up, but that's the thing, exactly as you said, you now know better. At the time when you did something or did not do something that maybe you could have done, you did not know better. You did the best you knew you can at the time. So it's not admitting that what you did wasn't optimal or back, you know, in the past. It's not that you're saying, oh yeah, you know, I was, it's admit. You knew that you did the best you could. You did the best you knew you could. And that's okay. That's all, the only thing we can expect of ourselves, to always do the best we know that we can until we know better. Is it Mariangelo that said? It's a very famous quote, isn't it? But really, that keeps you in the place in isolation until you find that courage to first look at yourself. Just first look at yourself. Because like you said, sometimes you have to stand the corner because you feel you're right. But if you suddenly reflect back and you recognize that maybe you could have done things differently, it's very, very, it's a very lonely place to be, to keep that to yourself. And to say it out loud, it both reconnects you to other people, and that vulnerability reconnects you to other people, and suddenly you're not alone because you're sharing their humanity with those around you. And that's where the empowerment actually comes from, where that self-leadership, that's how it manifests. But it's a practice. It's not just skills you learn that you're told, this is how you speak, this is what, you know, what you do. It's a practice.
Yeah, you talk about the loneliness, you know, the loneliness of being right. It's you either have to agree with me, or you're in a position where you have to be wrong. It's a very lonely place to make sure that everybody either agrees with you or is wrong. And I think if I often say this to people, I haven't been married for nearly 37 years by having to be right. And I think marriage, relationships, leadership, it's not about having to be right, because it becomes a very lonely place. And what you soon find is that you don't have people's support. You don't have people's respect. You don't have people looking up to you. They're constantly feeling, they're feeling, I don't know, threatened when they're in your presence. So I think the need to be right is something we need to overcome. You know, vulnerability, humility. Yeah, I mean, as a leader, have strategy, have direction, have inspiration, paint the big picture. It doesn't mean to say you have to defend that to the hilt. You can, the best project managers I know question and revisit the plan all the time. Is this still the right plan? Are we still on the right track? Have facts change? You know, you say, this is how I was back then. The facts have changed. I've moved on. I've changed who I am. I can now revisit that and do it differently. The project has changed. We have different objectives. The team has changed. The world has changed. Yeah, you know, COVID popped up. We had to change. So I think having a fixed view of being right or having a fixed plan can be problematic. I think what you're saying here is that by reflecting, be more introspect, self-aware, we don't have to hold on to all this stuff ourselves. And I think that's really key to put, you know, part of this changing ourselves first. And you say it's corny and cliche. It's not really. It is the fundamental, as far as I can see.
I think it's fundamental. It's only corny and cliche just because it's used so much and sometimes very flippantly. That's why it comes across as that. But what's behind those concepts or constructs, is for me, it is absolutely, it's the core of things. It's the essentials. And I really like, as you were saying about leadership, I heard this a few months ago. I was listening to some, or just watched a little clip on YouTube, and there was a coach as well talking to someone, some interview, and he was talking about imposter syndrome. But I think I apply it more wider, you know, a lot wider than in what context he was saying that. So this coach was talking about the imposter syndrome that he constantly had to battle at the beginning of his career. And so the interviewer asks, so, you know, how did you deal with that? What helped you? And so the interviewee described how he was working with the coach himself, which was, I think, of sort of a bit of Buddhist philosophy inclination. And the coach apparently had asked him, he said, why do you feel that you have to be the master of things? You know, you only need to be a guide. And he said that was what really helped him to, with time, overcome that imposter syndrome. And for me, that really stuck with me. And I think it's very much applicable both in leadership positions, because obviously they are in positions that create culture. So, you know, your workplace culture or your institutional culture. So it's very important that they see themselves as guides, which are a step or two ahead of other people that they are leading. And that is where they are leading. They are a step or two ahead rather than masters. Because when you fancy yourself a total master, it's a very slippery slope where you can slip into that, I know better and I'm not listening to anybody else. Whereas you just, if you, and that goes back to what you said, humility. If you perceive yourself as a guide, right, you know, so, you know, I have more knowledge, more experience than those people I'm leading in this particular field. And this is why I'm leading, but I don't know it all. So when you're in that guide mentality or mindset, you will continue progressing in your self-development, in your professional development, because you know that when you become a master or self-ascribed master, you that's it. That's kind of sealing a limit. That's it. I achieved whatever I had to achieve, and there's nothing else to be achieved in this area. So I know everything, and I'm an absolute authority. And it just doesn't work that way, because the world, as you say, is changing. So I really like that guide versus master metaphor. Like I said, it was in different contexts, but I apply, and it's everywhere, not just in leadership positions, in your personal relationships, in your social relationships.
I don't know who said it, but I'm going to say Richard Branson springs to mind. And his philosophy, or the person who's quoted this, his philosophy was, surround yourself by people who are better than you.
Mm.
Because one thing I've learned in my past life in computing and IT is I was always wanted to be the best. And generally, I had more expertise. But that becomes exhausting as well, because not only are you trying to lead, you're trying to lead with your views, your opinions, and try and bring people with you. And if you have a perception that nobody else is good enough or not as good as you, you'll never trust them. So I've learned that I would rather surround myself with people who are far more astute and skillful at what they do, and let them do it well, and be the guide. You know, you talk about being the guide, being the coach, being the mentor, create strategy through their expertise, and that also allows people to buy into the strategy, buy into the direction. Whereas if, you know, again, if as a leader, if you're the one that does all the talking and never the listening, how do you get people to buy in? You know, we talked about belonging right at the beginning. Belonging happens when you feel part of something, when you start to be listened to and contribute. If I just tell you what you're doing all the time, you're never going to feel belonging. You're never going to feel that sense of engagement or buy into whatever I'm doing. So yeah, I've learned that as a leader, that it can't all be about me. It's not about me. It's not about the leader. The leader, yeah, whether you use the servant model where the leader's at the bottom holding everybody up, or the visionary transformational model where you're painting a picture and getting people to follow. I work in a world where it's empowering people is important. Okay, if I was working on a production line, I was working in a very tight quality control environment, maybe that I'd need to take a different grip of the leadership enforcement, maybe. But yeah, I'm either there to serve, or I'm there to create strategy and direction, not micromanage or tell people what to think.
Yes, and for me it is also a challenge, because I'm a bit of a control freak. But I'm a control freak in terms of I make my own cups of tea, because no one can make me a good cup of tea, because that's just me. That's my problem. That's nobody else's problem. But I think that's another thing to recognize, that I shouldn't make something somebody else's problem. That is my problem. And that's just one of examples where I am a bit of a control freak. And I mean, I'm serious. It's literally, I'm very specific about my cup of tea. I know exactly how many times to dip the tea bag, because I like it weak. And yeah. So I'll just, if someone asks, do you want a cup of tea? I'll say, just put enough water in the kettle and I'll do it myself. And I always think, oh man, you know, the carers are going to hate me when I get old. So I hope that by that point, I somehow, you know, acquire different taste buds. But really it is that if you have that streak of things to be done a certain particular way, you also have to really weigh it up to what degree you can, or you justify it, you expect other people to do them in the same way as you do them. Because of course there can be times when the situation requires it, and that's when you become a leader, when the situation requires it. Because otherwise, for me, the way I see leadership is being supportive, being an approachable support to people around you, so they can really, really stop shrinking inside of themselves and to really open up and not just share the wildest of ideas, the most audacious, the most ridiculous ideas. That's what real leadership does. It's quiet, sitting there and observing, unless the situation requires that you absolutely step in and people are now looking up to you to lead them out of the stormy waters into the calmer waters when they again can develop and just be what they are. So with that having a certain, you know, me talking from someone, like I said, from a control freak point of view, I recognize that, and I recognize that my need for control for certain things should not become other people's problem.
I've also, picking up on that, I've also learned when it matters to somebody else more than it matters to me. So I can coexist with somebody who has strong opinions and is a control freak and whatever, because it clearly I can respect the fact that that really matters. It's like if I'm playing, I don't know, occasionally I play darts, I play pool, very, very occasionally. I don't have to win. I like a bit of a game. I like to chat. I like to play. If the other person really, really wants to win, is really, really competitive, I'm not going to let them win, but I'm not going to take it as seriously as they will. And I can coexist in that environment where I don't have to be competitive. And I recognize what someone else is. And I don't feel threatened by someone else's competitive nature. And the other thing I was going to say, when we were speaking earlier, I was thinking, I know when to walk away. I know when something doesn't matter that much to me. I'm either happy to acquiesce, capitulate, give in, or say, you've got the passion, go for it, I'll follow you. I'm more than happy you taking the lead. It's also no when to walk away from situations where it's toxic, you can never bring any change. It may well be me, and I'm quite admit this doesn't work for me. It's not you, it's actually no, yeah, I'm not here to change you. And it comes to a point where you have to accept that somebody else isn't going to change for you, at which point you decide you have the choice either to keep playing or step back. And I often know where my limitations are, and this environment's not for me, and I'm sorry, I'm out. It doesn't work. And it's recognizing that as well. You don't have to win in every game or even compete in every game you play.
That's very relatable of things you said, and I think it's probably relatable to everyone as well. And it is, I had to walk away from toxic relationships as well because it had to run its course. I achieved closure before I could step away from that relationship. And some probably would have said I should have done it earlier, but I didn't because I haven't got to the point where I achieved closure, and I didn't want to be left with, oh, what ifs if you do too early. But at the same time, like you said, you have to be open to stepping away because it just consumes your energy and really brings out the worst in you as well if you stay too long in those situations. And I don't regret those situations where I found myself from which I needed to really urgently walk away eventually. And I don't regret them because they really also showed me my shadows with which I can work then. Because before then, I wouldn't have known them. You know, they weren't exposed, they weren't illuminated because I've never found myself in the situations where they would rise to the surface. But And I have been provoked following that on numerous times, provoked into interacting in that same kind of defensive way. You know, someone will tell you that, oh, right, so you've got nothing else to say, that's why you're walking away. Or, oh, yeah, so you just, you know, just giving up. Or just things like that. You know, the provocative kind of language. But it's exactly what you say. You have to be secure in yourself sufficiently to not fall for that kind of provocation. And that for me is, again, practice, something that you have to constantly practice. It starts with awareness, continues with conscious, intentional, effortful practice until it then becomes easier to actually, you know, eventually it washes off like a water off a duck's back. Is that the saying, I think? But it is what we're all striving for, but we don't always recognize to that sense of self-leadership, self-efficacy, self-sufficiency, and sufficient self sufficiently safe self-image, but there's a lot of things that are packed into this. I mean, obviously there are decades and decades and decades of research into all these different tiny little threads of what self-leadership entails. And still not everyone agrees on the subject, but you have to start somewhere.
Lena, thank you. What an amazing conversation. How do people get hold of you if they want to find out more?
Right. I'm on LinkedIn mainly. That's where I am active on LinkedIn. You can find my contact details there as well. If you're more interested in, you can, if you browse, you'll see what I believe in, what I fight for. It's in fragments, but it should give you a taste. And if you don't want to go on LinkedIn and look for my details, the easiest way to contact me is the email address, which is queries@redefineandrewire.co.uk.
Fabulous. I'll put those in the show notes. Lena, thank you so much.
It was an absolutely wonderful conversation.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.